Welcome to Breathe, Baby, Breathe, a podcast from Community Healing Network where we engage culture carriers in conversations that light the path to emotional emancipation and cultural healing for people of African ancestry. Come, breathe in the fresh air of African values.
Welcome to episode 3 of the Breathe, Baby, Breathe podcast. I am Chandra Roxanne, your co-host for this episode with Anola Aird, the founder and president of Community Healing Network. And we are delighted to engage with Dr. Lisa Mube, who is the assistant provost of institutional assessment and professor at North Park University, and the author of a very influential article called Ubuntu, a transformative leadership philosophy. Dr. Mube, welcome.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being here.
Awesome. So one of the things that we do when we start off the episode is we like to acknowledge our ancestors, and we like to acknowledge the lineage that we are a part of, as well as the lineage that we are continuing and creating. And so to every guest, we ask this question, and that is, who are your people and who are you accountable to?
Thank you so much, Chandra, for that question. My people are the people of Zimbabwe, they are the people of Africa, and the people of the world. So I am not only accountable to my immediate family, my ancestral home, which is in Mchabezi Mission, southeast of Zimbabwe, southeast of Bulawayo, the second largest city in Zimbabwe. I'm also very much accountable to my God Almighty and all my people that have gone before me. I especially feel accountable to my late sister Laura, because she's always with me and walks with me every single day. She blessed me by allowing me to adopt her children upon her passing. And I'm also accountable to my dad, my grandfather, my grandmothers, my grandfathers, my great-grandfathers. I'm accountable to all my ancestors, because it is through me and through all of us from that particular clan, from that particular family, that the family name lives on. And it is upon me and all of my family members who are still here on earth that we do them proud when we do our due diligence on this earth, when we love, when we respect, when we dignify each other, and we care for each other. So those are the people that I'm accountable to.
That's wonderful.
That is beautiful.
Thank you.
And before I turn it over to Anola Aird to continue with the conversation, there is something unique about your name, and that is the click.
Absolutely.
And can you talk to us a little bit about the click in your name?
Oh, yes. And Chandra, you did pronounce it perfectly.
Oh, wonderful.
It is Mube. And Mube is spelled N-C-U-B-E. C is one of three consonants of the alphabet that click. C, Q, and X. But they make several different sounds depending on the combination of the consonants that they bring together, that they determine, the linguists determine to bring together. So my name, Mube, is from the Ndebele language. So that's my mother language in Zimbabwe. I speak Ndebele. Ndebele is one of the Nguni languages of Southern Africa, which include Xhosa, Zulu, and Swati. So these three languages, these Nguni languages, I may be missing one or two in there. They click, so we click, and there's no real significance in the click beyond the fact that that's the sound in our language we make, just like any other language. Whether you say as in snake or you say cup as in cup, it's just a sound, just like any other word sound. So but it's mainly, like you put it the other day, like snake and ono. Say it for me again.
Onomatopoeia.
Yes, thank you. So a lot of clicking sounds also are very much onomatopoeias. Like, for instance, our word for frog is xoxo, which is XOXO. Oh. And that's the sound. If you are listening it with a different ear, you hear the frog say. Mm-hmm. So it becomes xoxo. That's why the frog is called xoxo. linguistically, I'm no linguist, but I know a little bit about those those origins. So that's where these clicks come from. And there is another language, though, in Southern Africa that also clicks far much more than we click. And it's the San people of Botswana. So, and unfortunately, derogatory called Bushmen, and that's what most people know them as, but they are referred to as the San people. That's their real name, but they actually, I'm forgetting their actual tribal name, Basadi. That's what they're referred to in Botswana. So they click far much more than we do, their entire language. And I always encourage people, if you want to know a little bit about these San people, watch the movie The Gods Must Be Crazy. You will not only enjoy it, but you will learn a little bit of linguistics from how they click.
There is so much to learn.
We have a rich history and a rich culture.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And a rich language.
Yes.
So Lisa, the last time you were with us was May 25th, which is Africa Day. And we had a great Africa Day retreat, virtual retreat online, and it was extraordinarily uplifting. That was the feedback that we got, and it was most enjoyable to participate in it. And we called it Breathing the Fresh Air of African Values. We were almost 2 months into the COVID pandemic, and unbeknownst to us, on that very day began the other pandemic. It had been continuing, obviously, the pandemic of anti-Black racism has been going on for 600 years, but those two converged on actually that day, on Africa Day 2020.
Yes.
George Floyd in Minneapolis was, as we were meeting, he was being killed. Wantonly. And as we were meeting, the bird watching incident in Central Park was also happening. And so the next day we woke up to this news, and Chandra and I wrote a statement about another assault on Black life. And unfortunately, the assaults have kept coming. Breonna Taylor being, as we record this podcast, the most recent healing sorely needed in our community. The constant assaults, the traumatic assaults to our dignity and to our humanity. And we firmly believe that here at Community Healing Network, that the healing really has to, of course, take into account psychological understandings. And that's why we have been so grateful to be in collaboration with the Association of Black Psychologists. But what the other gift that they brought us is an understanding that our healing must also be grounded in our culture. Mm-hmm. And that African values are a crucial pathway to healing, which is why we have these conversations, and which is why we need these conversations so so urgently. So we're delighted that you're with us to breathe and take in the, share with us the fresh air of African values. And so I wanted to really start. You told us you were born in Zimbabwe. And to ask you to give us a little bit of the history so that we can locate the geography and the history, locate where it is, what countries surround it, and where, when did it become colonized? When did it become independent? Just a little bit of that backdrop so that we understand the geography and the history from which you come.
Thank you so much for that question. I am originally from Zimbabwe. I should say I am from Zimbabwe. However, I am now a citizen of the United States. But I still claim Zimbabwe to be my home. In fact, in our African culture, your home is where your ancestors are or where they are from. So it doesn't matter whether you travel 10,000 miles, excuse me, across the world, or you just move from one village to the next, your home will always be where your ancestors settled and claimed that land. So my home will always be Muchabezi Mission in the southern part of Zimbabwe. So Zimbabwe, officially the Republic of Zimbabwe, also previously Rhodesia, and prior to that, Southern Rhodesia, is landlocked in Southern Africa, is a landlocked country in Southern Africa, bordered by Zambia to the north, South Africa to the south, Mozambique to the east, and Botswana to the southwest. It also has, it shares what is called the Caprivi Strip, where four countries come together and at that particular point. So, and Angola also comes in here, Namibia also comes in here, Botswana is there, and Zimbabwe. So there is the Caprivi Strip, where if you are at the Caprivi Strip, you can actually go to any one of those four countries. So Zimbabwe is just sits right on top of South Africa in Southern Africa. So we're just north of South Africa, and we are divided by the Limpopo River to the south, and the great mighty Zambezi River to the north. So that's where, if you can geographically think of Africa, all the way to the bottom of the continent, and Zimbabwe sits right atop South Africa. Historically, Zimbabwe was colonized by the British in the late 19th century. That's when the white people started coming to the country. I don't know what it was just kingdoms then. There was no country then. So there were several different kingdoms at the time, but obviously, as with the rest of Africa, it was colonized by the British, taken over by the British, so it was under British rule. However, in 1965, Ian Smith and his government unilaterally declared independence. And so for many, many years until 1980, when we gained true independence, we were under settler rule. That's what we refer to it, because Smith and the rest of the people that had come to settle in then Southern Rhodesia were referred to as settlers. So we gained independence in 1980, And in 1980, our first president, who then stayed on for many, many years, was Robert Mugabe. So we've just had a second president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, after 1980 to about 2 years ago. How many years that was? That's how long Robert Mugabe ruled the country. So once he took over, he stayed on for a very, very long time. Actually, it was a coup that got rid of Robert Mugabe, but that's all part and parcel of the more recent political changes in the country. But in a nutshell, that's what Zimbabwe is all about.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that that background. I am very, very curious about your childhood and the value systems to which you were exposed in your home and then outside, since I'm assuming, based on what you've said, that you grew up in colonization during the time of colonization and then afterwards. And so I'm just really interested, as we think about in this moment, about the two competing value systems, the systems of the West, I think, therefore I am, radical individualism, materialism, as compared to Ubuntu, which we are interested in exploring as a pathway to healing. I am because we are, one formulation of it. We are persons because of other persons. How did those value systems operate in your childhood when you were little? You told us yesterday a wonderful story about little five-year-olds who have the responsibility in many cases of caring for, in particular ways, of young children, and that just sort of whet my appetite to want to know more about what childhood was like and how values get inculcated.
Thank you again for that question. It's very interesting to me that familial values, which are basically maybe tribal values, and you can enlarge them to Zimbabwean values, Zimbabwean cultural values, are very common across Africa. So it's one thing that I, having studied and been to many African countries, it's a constant theme. The African values are very, very, very much alike. So alike that for when I was studying in Sierra Leone, it fascinated me how, for instance, I learned Creole, I learned the Sierra Leonean Creole, how in Creole, a lot of the words that they use for strength, character, traits, those words that we use, for instance, somebody who is brave. In my language, we say that person has a liver. I'm not sure why the liver is considered a source of bravery. But also in Creole, they would say Igel liver, which basically means that he has a liver. And if somebody is too talkative, they say igem mot, which means they have a mouth. And in my language too, somebody who is too talkative or is quarrelsome, they say has a mouth. So that tells you something about how these values transcend borders. They transcend individual tribal cultures. So African values are truly African in terms of how widespread and consistent and are common across the African continent. And I can attest to that because I studied in Sierra Leone, which is way west of us in West Africa. And I've been to Ethiopia, Kenya, Tanzania, Botswana, South Africa, and a few other countries in between, Mozambique, you name them. And the values are very, very much the same. Number one, probably across all these different countries and cultures is relationships. Relationships that form the community are so very important. Developing those relationships so that we have a community that we call ours. We live in community. So most, if not all, African societies are very, very much communal, and we share that community. We live together in community, and many times in harmony. Of course, it's not nirvana. This is not paradise, but those are the values that we, when we are being our best selves, we try to live up to. But we are only human. There was only one Christ on earth, so don't expect us to be to be Christ. There is never going to be another Christ. So our human weaknesses will always take over, and then we have the issues that we then end up with. But relationships are very, very important in our African communities. In my culture, if I'm speaking about my culture in particular, and all the other African cultures that I know, for instance, we don't have anything called a distant relation. If somebody is related to you, they are related to you. There is no distance in relationships. So we don't talk about, oh, this is my distant cousin, or this is my second cousin twice removed. We don't remove people. We try to bring them closer. So that is one thing that is so very, very important to us, is those relationships. So if somebody knocks on your door, and of course you will let them in, the first thing that you do is greet them and you shake their hand. And then they just say to you, oh, I'm your uncle's wife's brother-in-law. Oh, really? Oh, come in. Oh, and you don't even ask, how long are you going to stay? So they just come in, and so the extended family is so very important to us, because those relationships are absolutely important. And then, of course, once you have a relationship with people, you cannot help but respect them, dignify them, show kindness to them, give them your time, be generous with them. So this person can be a stranger from nowhere, but especially if they can just say to you, well, I'm your so-and-so, whoever, their family, and that's the end of it. I remember when I first came to the United States, maybe not when I first came, a few years after I had come, and I had started working in Muncie, Indiana, I met somebody from Zimbabwe. And so obviously we'll ask, where are you from? What's your, what we call it, totem? It's not a totem pole, but rather it's what your, in the past, your clan, maybe your clan name or something like that, but we refer to them as totems. So if you have a similar totem, so this particular gentleman had the same totem as my mother, and he immediately became an uncle. And once he's an uncle, he behaves like an uncle. So he would bring us corn because he lived in rural Indiana, and so amongst the Amish people. So he would bring us corn. He'll bring us milk. He'll bring us. He even gave us one of his vehicles to just use because he's our uncle, and that's the culture that we come from. We didn't buy.
That was right. That and that was your childhood. That was what you soaked up as a child from your family, from your
absolutely
tribe.
Yes, absolutely. So that's those are the values.
Can you tell us the story of the 5-year-old and the baby?
And that's the other thing too, is that everyone, regardless of age, has a role and responsibility within the family. So from a very young age, you start contributing to the welfare and well-being of the family. So once you are able to walk and your back is strong enough and you happen to also to be a girl, because our society, for better or worse, is very patriarchal. So young girls would also tend to do a lot more than young boys. So at 5 years old, they start having you carry a younger sibling, a baby, on your back. You learn from that very, very young age how to carry a baby on your back. And the reason that they're doing it is not so much because it's child abuse, abusing, it's child labor, but the bonding between the siblings, and also the younger child has a softer back. So this baby, and it's for practical reason, the baby during the first few days before the umbilical cord has fallen, it's helpful for that umbilical cord to have some pressure on it. And so that is the very practical reason why they use the 5-year-old to carry the very small baby, because she is still delicate, the 5-year-old, and is able to carry the baby without hurting the umbilical cord. But it allows the umbilical cord to drop much faster when it is exposed to the baby's back for some reason. But that's one of the reasons. And then from that very young age, because you're already doing it, you do it once, you will always want to do it. So instead of playing with dolls, you're now playing with your young siblings. You're carrying your young siblings on your back. And it was very interesting to me that my grandchild, because I still carry them on my back, so my grandchild, who is only 3 years old, now wants to also carry babies on her back. So she carries her Ninja Turtles, her toys on her back. So she wants to carry her Ninja Turtle on her back because mm-hmm. she wants to do it like Gogo does it. Gogo means grandma. So mm-hmm. she also wants to do what Gogo does. And And this carrying of the baby on the back is a very practical aspect of our culture, because not only does it allow the mother to bond with the baby, because the baby's heart and the mother's heart beat together in rhythm, and the baby feels very secure because it just feels like when the baby was still in the womb and was hearing the lab-da-dum or whatever the sound is for the heartbeat. So it is carried on even outside the womb. And not only that, the baby is not just looking at people's feet. He or she has a vantage point of seeing the world around him or her, and is very, very secure in that environment. So it not only allows the mother to carry on with her daily chores, it also allows the baby to be very secure, very safe. And don't forget that, especially in days gone by, we had a lot of nature around us, snakes and other dangerous creatures, the baby being on the mother's back was the safest place the baby could be, and is still the safest place that the baby can be.
You describe so vividly what Ubuntu looked like then. And you've written this very powerful and much-cited article, Ubuntu, A Transformative Leadership Philosophy. We don't want to get into the philosophy in this conversation. We will do that later. But just for us to understand, how do you define what is the Ubuntu as one sort of central pillar of African values? How would you describe that?
So Ubuntu in Ndebele or Zulu is umuntu ngumuntu ngabanye. A literal translation is a person is a person because of others. And more, if we're going to translate it a little bit into more meaningful English, then it basically stands for I am because you are. You are because we are. And a true human being finds genuine human expression in human relationships with other humans. So that's basically what Ubuntu is. So I'm here not because of my own efforts. So I might be an associate provost at NorthPark. I did not become an associate provost at NorthPark through my own efforts, through my own strengths, and just climbed up the academic ladder on my own. It's because of the relationships that I have been able to form and recognize that I am where I am today. I am who I am today, not only professionally, but as a human being, because the professional aspect is secondary to my human values. That is what Ubuntu is about. So what you are professionally is least important. What we are most interested in when we talk about Ubuntu are your human values. So what are those human values that you express as a human being? Those are the ones that matter the most when we talk about Ubuntu. So they are...
What can you speak a little bit about what those values are?
So the most important one probably is, again, going back to those relationships, having those, developing and maintaining relationships with others, recognizing that you are not an individual. So our society is very anti-individualism. We are very much communal societies. So recognizing that you are part of a society, you are part of a community. And the only reason that you are here today is because of all those that have gone before you, all those that were before you and they may still be here on earth, and all those that are around you. That's why you are who you are today. So those relationships matter significantly. And in those relationships, it doesn't matter whether you are at the top or you are the pinnacle of that particular community or you're just an ordinary person. Everyone matters equally, and the relationship is what holds the community together. So those relationships are very important. And then, and how do we then express our Ubuntu in our African values? We express them by recognizing our elders, respect for elders, dignifying our elders, integrity, honesty, all those values that make us real human beings. Because Ubuntu is such a vital and an important element in our, not only in our identity, in our language, in our community, to the extent that if you call somebody a non-person, because that is the highest form of insult, is to call somebody a non-person. So we would say, aso muntu, you are not a person. Because when you are not a person, that simply means that you do not exhibit, you do not manifest, you do not show, or you do not behave in a manner consistent with a human being. So you can't be a person if you demonstrate those types of traits, values, lack of respect, lack of dignity, not honoring all elders, failing to, even something as simple as failing to greet visitors to your house. It's an affront to a lot of people. So if somebody comes to your house and the children have not been taught to greet visitors, that visitor will be very, very much insulted, because that is the first step towards developing the relationship. That handshake is so very important. So if you don't greet visitors, and that's one thing that we were taught as young children, people come, you all go around and greet each of those visitors with a handshake, because you're acknowledging their presence, you're acknowledging their humanity, you're acknowledging that they are here. And it's not only for the parents, but for everyone in the home. In fact, if children are not doing it, it's very disrespectful, because you're not showing respect to your elders.
We look forward to talking more about how this way of being manifests itself across the diaspora. But as you're speaking, as someone who grew up in Panama of West Indian parents, I completely relate to this. I completely relate to what would happen to me if I did not speak to Miss so-and-so and so-and-so with respect. Absolutely. If I saw her on the street, or if she came to my home. And no matter how old I am, she's always Miss so-and-so.
Yes, because, absolutely.
So I look forward to really, really exploring that, because for me, it's just a thrill. It's a thrill to be able to connect one aspect and more aspects of the way that I am and that I was raised to be, to African values. But I wanted to just go back a little bit and do this comparison, because Zimbabwe was this place of British imperialism and colonialism, and to talk about the value system that the British brought. And how did you see that value system? What were its characteristics, and how did it relate to Ubuntu and the value system that you grew up under as a child? And what effect did it have on you and your siblings and others in Zimbabwe?
That's a loaded question. It almost always brings me to tears when I recall the system that I grew up under, because it was at the time, I didn't realize how traumatic it is, or how traumatic it was, because it was, I didn't know any better. But in some ways, I also knew, because I had tasted freedom as a very, very young child when my family moved to Zambia and lived in Zambia for a few years. So we lived in Zambia up until I was about 6 or 7 years old. And as a young child, coming back to then Rhodesia, I was still able to see, to experience the differences in being free and the freedom, even for a young child at age 6. It was still very traumatic, and I continually and continuously asked my parents, why did we come to this horrible country? Because we basically lived under the Zimbabwean style or Rhodesian style apartheid or discrimination. There was a racial discrimination. Everything in the country at the time was completely separate. There were two ministries of education. In other words, there would be two departments of education, two ministries of health, two of everything. And the other department or the other ministry would only have barely a tenth of the resources that would be provided in the other. So there would be a ministry of African education, and there was a ministry of European education. And so we lived completely separate lives. The part that I found particularly insidious with the colonization of Zimbabwe was the way they were able to use the our own culture and customs to further subjugate, especially women.
How?
Okay, so our culture has always been very patriarchal, but it's patriarchal with appropriate structures, I would say. For instance, within our own societies, we have patriarchal females, like your paternal aunt is part of the patriarchy. And in some cases, they can be worse than any male patriarchal individual. So women participate in the patriarchy. So it's not like exclusively male. So women play a very, very important role. And in some cases, they play a bigger role in the patriarchal structures of our society. But so when the white men came, white people came to Zimbabwe, they took advantage of our culture in the sense that they used this patriarchy to further subjugate women. For instance, women, black women, African women, were considered minors from cradle to grave. You could not open a bank account without a husband, an uncle, a brother, a father. You could not stand legally in you're the lawyer, you know the legal term for it, I'm forgetting it now, but you couldn't go and stand in your own stead as a woman legally because you were a minor. Mm-hmm. And women could not inherit anything. So that was all codified into the law of the land for African people. That didn't apply to European women No, it didn't. It only applied to African women. So they actually took those patriarchal structures, corrupted them, and further subjugated women. African women could only hold two jobs, basically, and that was of a teacher and a nurse. And that's only because they needed teachers, obviously, to educate the populace to a level that they can use them more effectively. And nurses to make sure...
Can you speak more specifically about that question of how education was deployed, how education was really used as a weapon under colonization? You talked about the fact there was only a certain percentage of, there were only a certain percentage of people who were allowed to be educated.
Absolutely. Before independence, only 12 and a quarter percent of the primary school population was had places in the secondary schools. So that was the design. They, I don't know how they came up with 12 and a quarter percent, but they determined that that's all they needed at the next level, because the vast majority of the population they needed as laborers. So as long as they were educated enough so that they could communicate with the bosses, whether it was on the farms or wherever else they needed to be working at the laborer level, but they didn't need a lot of very educated people. So 12 and a quarter percent was enough for the secondary school, because then that 12 and a quarter percent would create enough teachers, enough nurses, at least on the women's side. The African men had a few more options. Like, for instance, my dad worked in the railways, so he was a guard. So they had a little bit more options for them. And but at the university, a few people, they still allowed a few individuals to go to the university. But one of the most interesting elements was how they would not accept Africans into the geology program, because they felt that Africans could not see or didn't have 3D perception. So they wouldn't be able to distinguish the different types of crystals, because geology is all about crystals. So there were no Africans in the geology program because Africans were not able to see things in 3D. Ah. So there are all these perceptions that they came with, including even carrying babies on the back. I read sometime in the 90s, an article written by a white woman how bad it is that African women carry babies on their backs, because all the baby sees is the back of the mother's head. And I'm like, how is this baby just looking up at the mother's head? Why is he not looking over here and looking over there and looking everywhere else around him? They always have these falsehoods and come up with completely false ideas that are not based in any fact, research, or science, and then that becomes the story of the day. That becomes the facts. They make those become facts.
What were the resources that they were exploiting in Zimbabwe?
Of course, the labor and the land
and the minerals.
The minerals, agriculture was huge, very very fertile agricultural land. Tobacco was Rhodesian tobacco was number one on the world market, and cotton. Too.
Mm.
So those were the big ones. Minerals were not as much, but agriculture was number one, followed, of course, by minerals. We also had a lot of coal, but labor. Oh,
labor. So you compared the colonization to enslavement. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about those similarities for you.
For me, in many ways, it was a very, very traumatic experience because number one, black people were not paid the same, but they were paid much, much less, way below subsistence. Most people needed to keep their families in the rural areas just to subsist. So there was a lot of subsistence farming just to survive because the wages that the people were being provided were way below. You saw this also even in South Africa where men were put in these hostels. So barely enough to really sustain a family. In slavery, many times, although we know there was a lot of assault on the family through slavery, we were also very much assaulted, put in jail and things like that. But sometimes it was almost like at least they had shelter, at least they had food. We, in many cases, did not have enough. And with the family, most cases, they had to be separated. And they also did it deliberately to keep the family unit divided so that it did not strengthen the family unit. So it was deliberate. At one point, women were not even allowed in the cities. You had to stay in the rural areas. And then that really, in many ways, destroyed, not completely destroyed, but it had a very negative impact on the family structure. There was also, but this is for another day, how the African woman, the geography of the African woman was also assaulted because of the African woman and therefore had to be kept away because she's such a dangerous entity in the city and a lot of other reasons that they were using to keep the family unit separate.
So talk a little bit about the impact of Ubuntu as a way of protecting against the predations of the West, and the, you know, what the end result was, as you see it, and then we want to end on a positive note because we obviously believe that going through this history is important. And Chandra, please don't hesitate to jump in here. That going through this history is important, but that we believe that ultimately our healing, our renaissance as people of African ancestry rest with our regrounding ourselves in Ubuntu, in regrounding ourselves in African values. But understanding this history is very important, and understanding the similarities.
Yes.
The similarities of how the West came, as Mary Makeba in that wonderful interview that she does when she's in Finland says, how they came and they conquered and they tell the story. You don't expect them to tell the truth about us. They tell a new story about who we are. And then they go around the world repeating that story and slandering us. So I guess the question is, how does Ubuntu survive all of this? And how does it keep you alive? Chandra, please.
You're muted.
My apologies. One of the things that really resonated with me that you spoke is at the beginning, you were saying that even though you are in Chicago and you're at North Park University, that your home is actually in Zimbabwe. No matter how far you go, your home is there. And I felt complete chills because I felt like, right, even those of us who were part of the slave trade, that there is this home for us. We're not, the 400 years has not severed that. And for me, it felt like, as a Black American, it felt like, it felt reassuring. And just that knowledge made me more intrigued about Ubuntu, because now I know that my home is in Africa.
Yes.
My ancestors came from Africa. That is my home. And I think for Black Americans, it's something that we struggle with, is that we don't have a home, or we feel as though we don't. We feel as though we don't have a home. So it's very hard to connect with people when you yourself are disconnected, or think you're disconnected from a group of people who have a home. Other cultures come here, they have a home. They can go back to China. They can go back to Latin America. They can go back anywhere. And it's like, at Black Americans, it's like.
But you know, Chandra, it's fascinating. When Lisa was speaking, I felt that way too. And I'm not American. I'm a Black Panamanian. And I do have a home that I could say I could go back to, except that that's not really a home, because the same problems, the same challenges that Lisa is talking about that happened in Zimbabwe about subjugation of Blackness happened in Panama. But I felt, almost for the first time in my life, when you said that, I felt a connection, even doing this work. For the last 14 years, I felt viscerally more of a connection to Africa as my home.
I wanted to burst into tears, because the past 4 years, I have been going around the United States, and I've done some international travel for the sole purposes of finding my home. Where can I put my roots? And I've never been able to find that place. And just hearing you say that, it just brought such a comfort, and it felt belonging. And the other thing that many Black Americans may feel is we don't have a sense of belonging. So if I don't have a sense of belonging, how can I then create Ubuntu, a sense of belonging, a family with other Black Americans who may feel like, I'm just sort of a leaf being blown wherever I go, and I just got to deal with wherever I land.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that that perspective we have about home. So for instance, I have been all over the United States. I almost feel peripatetic, or whatever the word is, working here, there, and everywhere. But it doesn't bother me, because this is not my home. My home is Mchabezi Mission. And in fact, it's interestingly, a group just more in this past week connected with me from back home. They are trying to supply water to our home. And what connection do I have? I have my house here in Chicago. Why would I even, they're looking for $200,000 to pipe water, because due to climate change and all those things, water has become a very scarce commodity over there in my rural home. But I even asked them, why only coming to me now? Why didn't you think of me first? Because this is my home. I am who I am because of that. And if I'm not a part of it, how is anybody a part of it if I'm not? So yes, I'm working with these people to try and raise these funds to for this water project, because that is my home. And it will always be my home. So it's very, very crucial because it is part and parcel of my identity. And unfortunately, people don't realize that their roots run deep. We are just leaves at the top of the tree, but our roots run deep mm-hmm. and they run all the way deep to Africa. So the fact that you're in Louisiana, you're in California, you're wherever, it shouldn't matter. If you recognize where your roots are, where your roots come from, mm-hmm. and realize that those roots run real deep, and all you need to do is to go down from those, because now you're all the way, you're just a tiny leaf up there somewhere, is to find where those roots run deep. Where are my roots? And because that is so critical to our identity. And when we know who we are, this is very important, then we become who we are supposed to be.
Exactly. And Dr. Mube, excuse me, I'm getting it. Dr. Mube, as you were talking, I remember when I was just sort of in a mist of confusion. I was in my kitchen and I just heard a small voice say, if you want to honor your ancestors, you've got to honor who they originally are. Slavery was just a chapter. It was not the beginning of the book. And it startled me. And I remember, like, right, because in the European or the Western culture, Black history starts with slavery. That's where the textbooks start. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I've been trying to do is to understand who they are, not just my specific group, but African people prior to the British invasion.
The British, the French, the Spanish, the Portuguese, yes, European, all of it, the Western, the European.
And trying to sort of, what is the word, hammer down, like trying to destroy the cement of your, you know, that the educational system
excavate
that your history starts here. Mm-hmm. We determined who you were. Your history starts with that, and to really penetrate through that to get to no, I'm actually part of the original people.
Yes.
Who civilized, not colonized, who civilized much of the world.
Nice, Chandra.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And to hear that out of the mouth of an African for me really helps.
Oh, I'm so glad.
I don't know. There's something going on inside. hearing from an African that yes, your home is actually Africa. That is home for you.
Yes,
where you originated.
Yes, hearing that is thank mm-hmm. you. Like the ancestors speaking through you and saying, yes. Mm-hmm. I'm being inarticulate, but I'm just saying.
No, not at all.
Not at all. You're making 100% mm-hmm. sense.
It just. Yeah. I have even right now I have peace. It's okay, I have my sense of belonging. So now I don't have to search for my sense of belonging.
No, you do not have to.
That's the gift. And now I'm looking for it.
And I think, it's implicit in the value system as you have described it, because it is the relationship, right? And the relationships, they extend across time and space.
Yes.
Right? And that's also deeply reassuring, deeply welcoming. And so for us, the process, the project is a project of reconstruction. It's a project of healing. Mm-hmm. And it's a project of learning and relearning who we are. And as we close for this conversation, we would definitely love to have another conversation with you. Is your thoughts on how what happened Martin Luther King describes in terms of cultural homicide, where people come, as you say, the white people come, and they destroy a culture. That's their goal, to appropriate these people for their purpose, which is about making money, which is about building up the wealth of the Western world. In the process, they just, they really decimate a culture because they don't care. Yeah, and they use it, misuse it. But Ayikwe Arma, who we absolutely love, Ghanaian author who writes The Healers, who says, yeah, there's this project. But here and there, a mind refused to die. Here and there, the culture refused to die. Here and there, the values refused to die. And we can see examples everywhere, not just in Africa, but in the diaspora, of minds and culture and values of African nature that refuse to die. So I'd love to end on that note. Where do you see the remnants, is not a good word, but seeds that refuse to be crushed, that are now here for us to nourish and grow in and reconnect to as a way of rebirthing ourselves.
Wow. That's really, really deep. But we see it in the work of people like you, Inola, like you, Chandra, your search, recognizing, because it's almost like the prospector, the water prospector or the gold prospector. You know the gold is there somewhere. You know there is water somewhere. And so you know, I used to see movies where they had the stick and then the stick, I think that was fiction, but it would lead them to the water. So through works such as these, you are following the seam. You're finding the seam because it is there. It's just buried. Mm-hmm. It's been buried under the cultural homicide, because when you kill or you try to kill a culture, you know, pieces fall and they become buried. And I remember coming to the U.S. and somebody was thinking, you must be suffering culture shock. I'm like, what culture shock? We were watching Baywatch. I just came home from watching Baywatch. So what are you talking about? I already know all these things. I didn't feel any. My only culture shock was that the carrots tasted bland and the eggs tasted like cardboard. But besides that, everything else was like, this is the way we live. We basically have misappropriated, reappropriated, or however appropriated Western culture and buried our own culture, but it's still there. So the water or the seeds, they're just buried, but they're there, and we just need work such as this to bring it to life, for it to regerminate, to actually germinate, and we will see these values come back to life. Mm-hmm. We need to be talking about it. When we talk about it like this and people recognize that, oh my gosh, I've been searching for something that's already within me. I don't have to go anywhere else. So this is what Ubuntu is all about. Ubuntu is about us coming together, reclaiming for ourselves what it means to be an African, a person of African descent. What does that actually mean? Let's reclaim it for ourselves and recognize that our values, our way of thinking, our way of living, our way of doing is what will help us survive today, tomorrow, and forever. Yes, because we lose our identity, and we see a lot of our children losing that identity, going astray, becoming very wayward because they're trying to find an identity that they already have. It's already there within you. You don't have to go far. You already have it.
In our global truth tour, we went to Omaha, Nebraska. We were on the property of the Malcolm X Museum, just a few feet from the house where he was born. And Dr. Imani spoke to us during our Community Healer Awards that evening, and he uttered words that I just, Chandra knows, I can't stop repeating because they were so, so deeply, so powerful and moving. He said that we Black people, and I think he meant everywhere. He wasn't just saying Black people in Omaha or in America. Black people embody in our very incarnation the struggle for the definition of what it means to be human.
Yes.
This, for me, was so powerful. There are two competing visions of what it means to be human, what it means to be a person.
Yes.
There is the European, or as you helped us understand, the Eurocentric version. I think, therefore I am. It's all about me, radically individualistic, materialistic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sometimes hedonistic. We're seeing the apex of it right now. Mm-hmm. And then the I am a person through other persons, this more complicated relationship driven way. And it has been, we have been the battleground on which that struggle has been fought with great pain, but we have borne it as a people around the world with incredible dignity. And it is bigger than us. And so when you say that these are the values that are essential to our healing and to our humanity, absolutely true. But I also believe and have believed from the beginning of this, very early on, not from the very beginning, but very early on, that it is also the values that are necessary for the preservation of humanity itself.
Yes.
Because Africa, as the mother of humanity, knows best.
Absolutely. To me, something else that's just so interesting is how when in English you refer to humaneness, that's there's no humanness, there's personhood, which is kind of closer to Ubuntu, but there is no humanness as a noun, an adjective. No, there isn't one. And when we talk about humane, when something is humanely done, it's always in reference to killing something kindly.
Yeah.
It's not about building up. So it's almost always in the context of destruction. Mm-hmm. Like the humane society.
Yeah.
You know, it's
fascinating.
So when we talk about, but with us, it's more about the life that we live every day, that we need to be humans first. And if we're humans and recognize what our human values are, that will sustain us not only as a community, society, country, but as a human race.
Yes.
Part of the reason why we have assaulted nature to the extent that we don't even know that if our grandchildren, great-grandchildren will have a world an earth to enjoy is because of our lack of Ubuntu, our selfishness. Ubuntu is not selfish.
Mm.
Ubuntu is kind, is love, it's dignified, it's respectful. So if you are all those things, you are also going to be in harmony with nature. You're not going to be so selfish as to want to basically destroy the world for your own benefit.
Yes. Wow. Awesome.
I think, Nola, you'll be okay if I make an executive decision.
You're our executive.
To add human.
Yes. Humanness.
Yes.
To
yes.
our growing vocabulary, our growing list of new words that we are creating as we are recreating this narrative going forward. I think
absolutely.
Humanness is very, very, very important. I'd like to add that.
And so for me, the so many insights coming out of this conversation, we have and are calling for 2020 to be the start, 2020 to 2030 to be the decade in which we mobilize to defy the lie of white superiority and black inferiority and more determinedly embrace the truth of black humanity. You have given us a beautiful set of words and concepts and ideals to flesh out what black humanity is, what black humanity is meant to be. And recognizing that in this space, Arna Bontom says, is there something we have forgotten wandering in these strange lands? And we talked about that on Africa Day. There's a lot that we have forgotten.
Yes.
What it means to be human. And it's not just us as Africans wandering in these strange lands. We have been wandering in lands that have forgotten. Lands constructed by people who have long ago forgotten what it means. Mm-hmm. So that gives us our mission. That gives us our purpose to heal ourselves. But not just for ourselves, because Ubuntu is not selfish.
No. No.
Yeah.
And if I can just
Sandra.
Add, listening to, we've also, CHN has also made or have declared 2020 to 2030 being that decade that we embrace Black humanity. And I know that that's something I've been talking with people, our participants in our Ubuntu healing circles, like, what does that mean? What does that look like? And as you were speaking, I had to write it down that we come into our humanity in relationship to each other. So I realized that, wow, we embrace the truth of Black humanity by being in relationship with one another. It's
absolutely.
Not individually, but no. it's a interdependent kind of action. It's not
yes.
singular things. It's a group.
No.
It's a group hug. So
which is why. This is so appropriate, the community healing. You're not talking about individual healing.
Yes.
Because it's Ubuntu and our culture is always about the community. It's not about the individual. I can share so many stories about things that go wrong, but because of Ubuntu that is within us, within me, I am able to do certain things that people from here wouldn't understand. Why
yes.
would you do that? Why do you send money back home? Why are you working with this group of people and you will never ever probably see that place again? But that is still my home. It
yeah.
is just like alumni of universities and colleges forever associate themselves because a part of it is because they're trying to find their home somewhere. That's the only home they can think of.
Mm.
I'm an alumni of that place. I will forever associate myself with it and I cannot let it go down
mm-hmm.
because that is my home forever.
Yeah.
Forever.
And my children's children.
Forever.
Forever.
This has been wonderful.
Absolutely.
Absolutely wonderful.
Thank you all. Yes, this is wonderful. I just want to thank you for this wonderful opportunity to not only share my culture, but to be in real conversation and discussion about where do we go from here as people of African descent. What does our tomorrow look like? Mm. And the hope that we can find in
each other.
In each other. And bringing back our original values.
Yes.
Because that is what is going to sustain and help us survive the assault and the trauma that so many of us suffer.
Yeah, yeah. And the good news, sisters, is this. Africa, in the midst of this COVID pandemic, stands out as a success story.
Yes.
Not to say it's unaffected.
No,
but
no,
it has managed to do this with such
limited resources.
Limited resources, having had the experience of Ebola and being mm-hmm. able to... It's astounding. I keep saying that there's an article in the Washington Post that was there day before yesterday. And I keep trying to take that link and put it on my Facebook page. And it's basically how the Western press has been ignoring the success in Africa.
Yes.
Because they don't want, it doesn't fit into their stereotype. And so every time I put it on my Facebook page, another article comes up. I mean, even when if I share it, even when I go to the link of the Washington Post, they really don't want us to share this. But I'm going to keep doing that because it's such a fascinating story. So, you know, we know the end of the story. Africa wins. Africa wins. And this is a wonderful thing. And I am just so grateful to be a child of Africa, a daughter of Africa.
So one of the things that we do is since we opened with our ancestors, we also close with our ancestors on the breath and the words of our ancestors. And so one in particular is Bea Richards and her poem, Today. Today is ours. Let's live it. Love is strong. Let's give it. A song can help. Let's sing it. Peace is dear. Let's bring it. The past is gone. Don't rue it. Our work is here. Let's do it. Our world is wrong. Let's right it. The battle hard. Let's fight it. The road is rough. Let's clear it. The future vast. Don't fear it. Is faith asleep? Let's wake it. Today is ours. Let's take it.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Breathe, Baby, Breathe. Listen in next month for another conversation offering emotional and cultural strength for the journey ahead. Visit communityhealingnet.org to learn more.